Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will chat with an author who wrote a book about how to find common ground in divisive times. He'll also speak with experts on mental health and new efforts to recruit medical students. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
We live in a time of deep polarization, where finding common ground proves not only difficult, but often impossible. In the boardroom, at the dining room table, in the backyard, in office. Jeff Williams is a civil engineer, he's a CEO, and he was the former mayor of Arlington, Texas, where the Texas Rangers play. In his new book, The Unity Blueprint, he shares strategies to help leaders unite business, government, and communities around shared goals. Welcome to Columbus Perspective, Mr. Mayor.
Jay, thank you for having me on, and very excited to talk to you about the importance of unity.
Well, let's start with your definition of unity. How would you put it into a sentence?
Well, that's bringing people together for a common purpose, to accomplish some initiative, to do good, and then listening to them and working on a vision and a plan. And then suddenly that plan isn't my plan, it's our plan. And we're able to move out together and eliminate dissension and conflict and instead be productive and make things happen that can really make a difference.
Boy,
and
that is very reminiscent of the late Senator Bob Dole's playbook. Did he influence you in any way?
Well, no, he didn't. I can say I've had a lot of different mentors over the years, but that wasn't one of them there. But certainly he was a great senator. But I can tell you that it was the way that I have seen so many of, including my dad there when I first started there. And then it's more fun when you've got people together, working together. And sometimes when you don't succeed, you've got others there to pick you up. And then when you do succeed, it's so much more fun when you're working together and friendships are forged.
How do you accomplish that in a time where you are either far to the right or far to the left, and there isn't very much room in the middle?
Well, I think it's you begin with having a purpose that everyone shares. And it doesn't matter whether you're an introvert or extrovert, when you're working on something that people have a passion for, you can bring them together because you listen to the different viewpoints and then you work on that common vision. And because they all have the same goal, you have a great opportunity to make it happen. But of course, you've got to make a plan. I call it map it. You know, so many don't make a plan, and consequently, they stumble and don't have a way to move out. And then also many don't listen to their employees or their stakeholders in developing that plan. And then, of course, the other part is a leader's got to research, because sometimes you get bad ideas. And when you get a bad idea, you've got to be able to know why, or to be able to share with them why it's a bad idea, but then encourage them to bring back others. And then when it's a good idea, even if it may not be better than yours, use it, you know, move out.
Leadership is not an easy task, and getting folks to follow toward a common goal is often problematic. Are you a horse person by any chance?
Yes, I am, as a matter of fact.
All right, so you've got a stubborn mare in the ring who's not giving you what you want. How do you get that horse to join up and follow you?
I love that, Jay, because first of all, that horse has got to know you care. People need to know that you care. You've got to value people and respect who they are. And then the other thing, you've got to feed them. And it's amazing there what can happen around a table too there when you're breaking bread with people. And that helps to break barriers, especially when you're talking about that common purpose. And we all are made to live in community and to work together. And in fact, there's no better feeling than when you're accomplishing something as you work with others to really make a difference.
Give us an example of something that you faced when you were the mayor of Arlington, where you were trying to accomplish something for the greater good, but you had opposition and you had to win them over.
Well, that's pretty easy. We've had a lot of those here in Arlington, but I'll share with one. Our Major League Baseball team, the Texas Rangers, were being courted by many of the cities here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. They each wanted the Rangers to come to them, and that's understandable. And I was coming in as the new mayor. And, of course, some people wanted to keep them, some didn't. But what I saw is that because of the economic impact that we needed to keep them, but also I had seen what had happened to one of our neighboring cities when they had lost the Dallas Cowboys, and how the morale of the city went down, and it just they really stagnated. And so literally I needed thousands of people to come together and work for me. And so I worked with a smaller group of people to work on a plan and develop a plan. So literally the day I got elected, I set up a meeting with the owner of the Rangers, and we started on that plan. And we started out with 15 people, and soon that gathered to several hundred and literally several thousand to keep the Rangers in our city. And it actually turned into a catalyst for us to bring the largest entertainment complex outside of Vegas here, which was Texas Live, then moved to Lowe's Hotels. And then ultimately we were able to land the National Medal of Honor Museum to come to our city. So it's amazing what can happen when a large group of people can come together.
Now, outside of city government, the bigger picture isn't always so obvious. So if we're trying to get that horse that is afraid and not trusting, how do we get them to do it when we're outside of a government or corporate entity? How does it work in the real world?
Well, it's very interesting right now, because our world is full of dissension and division. And in fact, in the business world, we spend so much time in conflict resolution, and yet we need to work to be proactive. And I think it begins, as I mentioned, valuing people. Just as that horse knows whether or not you care for him or not, it makes all the difference in the way that horse acts towards you. In the same way with people. And so in your workplace, you've got to set up an atmosphere and develop a culture to where they know that their leaders do value them, and that you will listen, and that when you listen, you don't listen to speak, you listen to understand. And truly, you do involve them in the planning. And of course, again, you've got to have a plan. So many times leaders will be promoted to a manager or a CEO, and they just start responding to the everyday life instead of being proactive and developing a plan to move ahead. And I was speaking to a group of Chick-fil-A managers, and I asked them the question, what do you want to see in your leaders that you're answering to? And the question was answered very clearly. They want to be able to trust the leader, and they want the leader to value them. And that's so important for our leaders to adopt character values, so that they can truly trust the leader that they have, and know that they're going to be able to move forward and will be listened to and will be valued.
I find it personally disturbing when I ask younger people if they want to take a leadership role, how many of them say, you couldn't pay me $1 million to get into politics, you couldn't pay me $1 million to be the boss. What would you say to those people with potential who want to accomplish great things but are afraid of all of the hurdles that come with the position?
Jay, what you said is just so true. I think that we have so many of our younger people that are scared of the responsibility. But yet I think the answer to that is training and fostering it and show them the path to success. And in fact, we spend a lot of time on training here in our company, and we try to give them a vision for how their pathway could be and what they can do. And then you remove the unknown And then you also build confidence because then they actually know what's ahead. They know how to deal with it. It's amazing there how important training is. And then I'll give you another example. In our community, we have started a civic engagement class that runs for several months, in which anyone that's interested in running for local elected office can come through there. And basically, they are in a forum where leaders actually come in and show them how they can practically run for office and what all is involved, what they need to do. And it's been extremely successful for us to be able to actually have people that said, I can't, I won't, suddenly say, I can do that. And then they are ambassadors to go out and spread that, because, Jay, it is a real problem. Having people step up into leadership, you need great people willing to do it. And we need to be able to remove those barriers and make it happen.
So this greater future and being able to continue with the way things are in terms of leadership, is that what inspired you to write the book, The Unity Blueprint?
Absolutely. It is so hard, and I'll just start right in business. You can spend all your time in conflict resolution, and what happens is morale of your employees goes down. Their mind is occupied in what happened and the strife that's happening, instead of when you promote the opportunity here for you to work together. Then suddenly you are productive, your morale goes up, and friendships are forged, which is one of the most important things. In fact, if people think about the great friends they have, they probably work together with them on a school project or a civic project, perhaps at their church. And it broke down that barrier, and you really learned about the person. Besides, at the end, there's nothing greater than to know that after you've worked on an initiative, you've made a difference.
At one of my first radio stations, they used to have a button that says, first, we make friends, then we sell products to our friends. And that never left me, because people are buying the relationship, not the product. And that stands true in almost every aspect of life. So where can we get this fabulous book, The Unity Blueprint?
Well, you can go straight to Amazon. We are featured there, The Unity Blueprint by W. Jeff Williams, and we are number one Amazon bestseller in business ethics, business organization, and Christian leadership, all in there. And I do think it will be a great read for anyone that is leading, whether you're in a business, a nonprofit, or a civic leader. There are lots of principles and tools for you to use, and we're all striving there to make a difference. And so consequently, we need to start taking the time to do that. Forbes actually published the book, and they shared with me that that Americans want unity. They're just not doing a lot to create that unity. And so hopefully this book will really start a movement towards unity, along with so many others. I'm running into a lot of people who are wanting to make this happen. So it could be a great cycle change here in America.
Well, I hope our listeners here in Columbus, Ohio, will take heed and continue to volunteer and be involved, because we need them in Central Ohio. I want to thank Jeff Williams for being our guest today, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
I asked my doctor when I went for my annual checkup last week, why did you become a doctor in the first place? He said, well, I wanted to help others, I wanted to make a difference, and I wanted to save lives. In my 57 years of life, I've heard that response more often than not. But reclaiming the why in medicine seems to be an important topic, as the Ohio State Medical Association is supporting physicians in the future of the profession. Dr. Gary Katz from the Ohio State Medical Association joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Does that answer surprise you, what my doctor said?
Hey, good morning, Jay. Thanks for letting me onto your program and taking some time to spend with me about physicians and the way they practice, and quite frankly, the reason they practice. And what you said resonates with me greatly. Finding the why, the purpose behind our practice, is really important. And quite frankly, it's becoming harder and harder for many physicians.
You know, I sense that. And I have a lot of friends who are physicians, and some have actually chosen to leave the profession out of frustration with pharmacy benefit managers and insurance companies. So my question for you is, first and foremost, for our listeners, what is the OSMA and how long has it been around?
Yeah, the OSMA is the Ohio State Medical Association, and we've been around for, I'd say about 150 years. I think our date of founding was 1846. So I'm not great at public math, but I'd say something like 180 years or so. And during that time, our mission has been the same, to advocate for physicians and the patients we care for, really trying to place that patient-physician relationship at the center of everything our physicians do.
What are the biggest challenges that physicians are facing right now in their practices?
Well, I'd say that the biggest challenges are the administrative burden and the other things that come between the patient and the physician who cares with them. As I mentioned just previously, that patient-physician relationship is critical and core to what we do. Without that, there is no healthcare. And so the burdens that prevent that relationship from being built just frustrate physicians and on. If I can add, there's a survey done earlier this year that said only 12% of physicians today say they would recommend medicine as a career. And many of them cite the administrative burdens of practicing as the reason why they might look elsewhere.
If you were to have a private conversation with a student considering medicine, and that student said to you, Dr. Katz, can doctors still help others? Can doctors still make a difference? Can doctors still save lives? What would you tell them?
I would say that the answer to those questions are yes. And it's the reason why I continue to practice. I've been in practice, I got out of medical school in 98, and so some residency training, and then, 25 years or so since then after residency. And I love it. I love being able to go to the bedside as an emergency physician and being able to help a patient and help them find comfort or care or cure on what, frankly, is their very worst day. And there is no calling, to me, there is no calling that is greater than that. So if you are into trying to make a difference for people when it really counts, when it really matters, then medicine is likely a career for you.
In January, the presidential administration changed, and that has affected the practice of medicine, especially with the new Health and Human Services Secretary. Talk to us a little bit about how that change has affected physicians directly.
Well, Jay, anytime you introduce uncertainty into an environment, it creates angst or concern. And I will tell you that what physicians really want to do each and every day is go and see their patients, work with their patients on whatever care plan it is, towards cure, towards comfort, towards wellness, and really place that patient at the bedside as their main core and purpose. So physicians all across Ohio are waking up today, going to their office, going to the ERs, going to the hospitals, and putting that patient first, and that's what we want to see happen.
What happens when a patient comes to a doctor and has heard disinformation? For example, Tylenol causes autism, or we shouldn't get vaccinated because that causes autism, or some other malady when the scientific data says it does not. What does the doctor do?
Well, this is why the relationship that a physician has with his or her patient is so critical. And everything that gets in the way of that relationship creates problems with uptake of true scientific information. For example, if I can say, do you know that physicians spend about 13 hours a week spent on what's called prior authorization? And just for your listeners' sake, that's the paperwork that's done to get the test that your doctor recommends approved by the insurance companies. That's time spent away from the bedside. That's time spent away from building that relationship with you, the patient. And that's time spent away from helping you, the patient, understand the mass of misinformation that's out there and how to understand, interpret, and apply the science as we know it.
How did it get so complicated? I remember being a child in the 70s, and it was never like this. What happened?
Well, I think there's a lot of changes within the healthcare system as our U.S. Healthcare is practiced. A lot of that has to do with consolidation. You see consolidation of insurance companies being vertically integrated. And what that means is your insurance company just doesn't insure your healthcare. They also own the pharmacy, or what you mentioned earlier, the pharmacy benefit managers. And they can also own the physician practices. And so that's just one example of the great consolidation that's happened within our country. And each time that happens, it risks the reduction of choice for you, the patient, and it risks the autonomy, mastery, and purpose that your physician can find in his or her daily practice.
I would also submit that it focuses practice on profit rather than on medicine.
I wouldn't doubt that at all. I think that there's a definite trend in the United States towards corporate capitalism. And regardless of your philosophy on economics, I would say that, again, I want to bring you back to physicians' desire to practice with the patient at bedside. That's where the decisions need to be made on healthcare. You and your doctor need to be making decisions together on what's right for you, because what's right for you, Jay, may not be what's right for your neighbor. And an insurance company, a legislator, another regulator shouldn't be making those decisions for you. Those decisions belong in the exam room between you and your physician.
One of your stated values is access to high-quality, affordable health care. How are you making that happen here in the Buckeye State?
Yeah, well, I just look at my own practice. I am an emergency physician, and I work in rural Ohio. My practice group staffs in four rural communities, some of which are critical access communities, and we're bringing high-quality emergency physicians out to those communities to allow that high-quality care to happen close to home. Every time a patient gets transferred from the rural community to the big city, it creates a burden, a financial burden on the economic system, a burden on the family that then has to decide, if I'm going to participate in Granny's care while she's admitted to the hospital, do I have to drive 2 hours to the big city to participate in that care and maybe risk missing work? Or can we safely care for that patient, for Grandma, in the local hospital, which allows me to go to work and participate in Grandma's care?
There is some concern with regard to budgeting and state and federal cutbacks that the rural medical community is going to take the brunt, and that people will, in fact, have to drive to the big city if they want care. What do you think is the reality of that conjecture?
I think that reality or that conjecture is quite possible. I don't know that it will happen that way. I can't foresee the future, but I can say that that's a definite risk. And I think that the government might recognize this a little bit as well. You might be aware that CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has recently issued a program for the Rural Health Transformation, which is a program. I'll let them speak to the details of that program, but the essence of it, for what's important to your listeners, is that this helps enhance access to rural care, or for care for rural patients, and helps keep that care local. And local care is really what I think our patients desire to have.
How is AI going to impact the practice of medicine as we look forward?
Well, that's a great question, Jay. I guess I could ask chat to tell me an answer for you, but the reality
that's
is
cheating,
chat.
Gary.
I'll tell you the truth, Jay. We don't know what exactly AI will do. There's great opportunities and great risks. What we know is that AI can help physicians be more efficient in things that take away from patient care, such as documentation. Again, removing the computer screen from that exam room is something that helps enhance that patient-physician relationship. That's a positive. That is a potential great benefit for you, the patient. Now, here's the risk. There are organizations, such as insurance companies, that are using AI right now to help review your chart before making a determination of denial for the services that are recommended by your physician. Do we really want to have a computer make those decisions? Isn't the human touch what's so very important? Isn't the human touch the reason why we go see the physician in the first place? That patient-physician relationship, the team of humans together making the decision about the care that's right for them.
What frightens me the most about that, Gary, is that it excludes the possibility for mitigating circumstances. Because if we're going to provide medical care based on an individual, when we introduce that component, it becomes generic.
I would not disagree with you at all. I think that human touch, the sense of what the patient and physician share with each other, is critical to the right decisions being made at the bedside.
What an interesting time to be a doctor, but still a time to help others and to make a difference and to save lives. Where can we learn more about the OSMA?
Jay, thanks for asking. As I said, the OSMA is working every day to break down some barriers and keep care local and accessible. You can see us at osma.org and on online as well as social media. And if you're a physician, just give us a call at the Ohio State Medical Association and help us help you. And if you're a patient who wants to know more about how you can help your physician keep care local, please reach out to us as well.
We want to thank Dr. Gary Katz for being our guest this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Friday, October 10th was World Mental Health Day. While Central Ohio residents tend to take care of their physical well-being, their mental well-being may not receive the same priority or attention. Max Lovato is a licensed professional counselor with Affirmations located in Columbus, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I am good. Max, how long have you been in practice, and what drew you to this career path?
So I've been in practice for about 4 years, and what really drew me in is taking care of, kind of like what you mentioned in that introduction, which is taking care of people and their mental health. So I'm actually going to go down a teaching path, and I realized I cared much more about how the students were emotionally, and that kind of steered me in this direction.
Anxiety and depression are two of the most talked about mental health concerns today, but there are many others. Give us some examples of some mental health conditions that you've seen in the 4 years you've been practicing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a huge range of things. Like you said, anxiety, depression, ADHD, autism, kind of existential crises of a lot of different varieties, personality disorders, bipolar, schizophrenia. I mean, the spectrum goes pretty far and wide.
How does one know that they might have a problem?
You know, usually that's a great question. Usually people start with the question of, what's wrong, right? You sort of notice things in the beginning that may feel off from what you're normally feeling. That's usually our first clue. And what we hope to do in therapy is figure out, okay, what has changed and how can we get you to where you want to go?
Sometimes we don't know where we want to go. What do we do in that case?
Ah, yes, that is a million-dollar question in therapy, and that's what we hope to talk about. Because you're right, a lot of people tend to kind of not know, at least actively, where they want to go. So that's something that we work on in therapy, is figuring out what is authentic for you. What are things that you value that you hope to live in the world? And those can be difficult to discover, but beautiful when they are found.
Our mind does three things. It concentrates on the here and now. It provides an outlook for the future, positive or negative, and it also brings up memories of the past. How can those three integrate in a positive way rather than in a negative way?
Oh, for sure. You know, and that's one of the places that we start is trying to gain awareness of kind of the history of you, right? Like what makes you, what has happened in the past, what's going on in the present, and where do you want to go in the future? And bringing that awareness and insight can help us figure out, okay, what are some habits that you want to change? But equally as important, what are the strengths that you bring to your life? Because I try to tell my clients all the time, you know, I never want to make this the what's wrong with you hour every hour, because we also want to identify things that you're doing well and that you want to continue doing well and build off of.
So you started your practice towards the middle to tail end of COVID. How much did COVID impact your patients' lives, and how are they doing now?
Greatly. Yes, I started my internship in the middle of the pandemic, right around the fall of 2020 into the fall of 2021, and then started practicing at the end of 2021 going into 2022. And I can tell you, Jay, a huge amount of things changed. I think the pandemic really helped people, especially when people were at home, really kind of give more thought to kind of what we talked about earlier, which is, how do I authentically want to live? You know, a lot of people had, for better and for worse, more time than ever to reflect on their own lives. And I'd say 5 years post-pandemic, people are definitely doing better, but still coming to grips with the after effects of a lot of those social changes that took place.
October 10th was World Mental Health Day, and while that's nice to have a dedicated day, shouldn't every day be Mental Health Day?
Absolutely. Yes, it is. And it's a lifelong pursuit. It doesn't mean you'll be in therapy for many years, but the things that we learn in therapy, we can apply until we exit the earth.
Sometimes it takes an outsider to point out that something might be wrong. We may not know. So what can a friend, a relative, or a coworker look for as a sign that someone might be, and there's so many levels, but they might be at some level of crisis?
Absolutely. As friends and family, when we can start to notice if we see any changes in our loved ones and people that we care about, and kind of contrary to common belief, it's okay to address those things directly. Like, it's okay for me to say, hey, Jay, you know, I've really noticed lately you seem different than what you normally are. Like, tell me what's going on. And then hopefully we can kind of work together to figure out where would be the next step for you to go. Because it isn't always therapy. A lot of times it can just be focusing on friendships with our friends and family and strengthening those and really bringing that bond of community together.
Well, and a lot of those behavioral changes manifest in different ways. If you have a sunny disposition and suddenly you have a more dour outlook on life. If you've not been a heavy drinker and you're drinking more than usual, if you're eating less than you normally eat, if you're sleeping less and look haggard, those are some of the outward signs that are visible. But what might be some of those inward signs that are hard to spot?
Right. And that's where we have to look inward. And some of those oftentimes manifest physically that we can only feel. Oftentimes, especially with things like anxiety, you know, we may feel our heart race, our chest tighten. We might go numbs in our fingers and our feet. We could get really bad headaches and migraines. Our joints and our muscles can ache when they normally don't. Those are physical signs that kind of come through, and mental signs can be really, you're kind of ruminating on things that have either happened in the past or what you might think is going to happen in the future. That's a hallmark of anxiety, is focusing on the future, and the past is us being, or the depression is being drawn to the past, where we tend to dwell on the bad things that have happened to us.
So you talked earlier about working with your patients to not only identify the problems and get to the root cause, but also identify the things that are going well. Paint a picture for us of what mental healthy lifestyle, what a healthy mental existence might look like. And I know it's highly individual. I know it's individual.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's a great question. And really what we're looking for out of therapy is not, you know, some sort of lasting happiness, because that, just like sadness, that goes away always. What we want to focus on is psychological flexibility and balance, right? So being able to handle whatever life throws at us, whether it's good or bad. And individualized on that scale is being able to act authentically, even when we feel anxious or depressed. That's really kind of a great marker of good mental health, is that overall kind of peace and balance.
So we're coming upon the holiday season. And when we get to holidays like Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's Eve, people who we may not have interacted with on a regular basis during the rest of the year are suddenly around us and we're interacting with them. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's less than positive. What are some tips for surviving the holidays from a mental health perspective?
I like the way you put that, like surviving the holidays, right? Because that's what it can feel like for so many people. And believe me, I've had those moments too. You know, we're all human. And one of the first things I really talk about with not only myself and other clients is taking a deep breath. Let's say you're at the Thanksgiving dinner table and things might be going wrong. That's okay that things are going wrong. Let's take a break. We can remove ourselves from the situation temporarily, take some deep breaths, and start to notice, okay, how am I thinking differently right now? What am I feeling, and where do I feel that in my body? That practice is called mindfulness, right? Being in the present with what's going on, because it's totally okay to feel those emotions during the holidays. We all do, trust me.
So if I get up from the dinner table at Thanksgiving and I go outside and people want to know why I'm outside, I can say, you know what? I needed to take a pause to be mindful.
Absolutely, right? Because, you know, it may not even be anything necessarily wrong with our family. Sometimes we just get overstimulated and we need to take a break from all the chaos sometimes. Even if we love our families and actually enjoy being there, sometimes it can just be too much for us. It's okay to take that break.
Not everybody is as comfortable as you and I are in talking about these subjects. They're very sensitive. So if we want to direct someone to a website that might give them a handle on how things are, or maybe allow them to have some sort of a questionnaire that at least directs them where they should go, what would you recommend?
Well, first I'd recommend at least, you know, our website, affirmationstherapy.com, you know, and those are some things that we can actually talk about on just a intro level, even if it doesn't relate or kind of go to a long-term therapy. It can always be nice to just even have a session or two just to figure out, okay, what kind of information, what kind of care would be best for you? Because I've certainly had plenty of clients that they just kind of need to pop in for 4, 5, 6 sessions, get some things straight, and then be on their way, and they can always come back later.
And beyond the affirmations care site, something that might be a little more generic?
Generic? I'm not sure off the top of my head, to be honest. There's kind of no information centralized zone for that. The best I can think of would be Psychology Today. Mm-hmm. They often have more kind of generic but really brilliant articles on kind of general mental health tips.
And that is always helpful. Sometimes we learn by doing, sometimes we learn by reading, sometimes we learn by talking, but as long as we're learning, we're making progress.
Absolutely.
I want to thank Max Lovatta for being with us. Affirmations in Columbus, Ohio is where he's from, and you know where I'm from. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State, A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Well, Columbus says it's time to invest in the city's infrastructure, but those improvements will come at a cost. You may need to prepare to pay more on your water bill. 10TV's Kevin Landers looked into where the money is going and how much it could cost you.
From ensuring the water that comes out of your tap is safe to drink, to building two upground reservoirs to battle the impacts of drought, to removing lead from water pipes and building more rain gardens to reduce stormwater overflows. All of it costs money, and the city plans to charge residents more to pay. The city says after a decade of holding price increases at or below 5%, it's time for a price adjustment. The other issue, keeping up with growth. Columbus's population is expected to reach 3 million people by 2050. Here's what the city is asking for: an 11.7% increase for water, sanitary sewers, and stormwater. That translates to more than $100 more per year for Columbus customers who use 165 gallons of water a day. That price would jump to $149 more per year if you live outside the city. If you get your power from Columbus, you could be looking at a possible 13% increase on your bill. The city says it's the first price hike in 18 years for its 19,000 customers. It blames the price jump on the high cost of energy. Columbus plans to use the money to complete its smart lighting project that would install LED lighting for all streetlights in the next 3 years and add streetlights to unlit neighborhoods.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan, and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.